Welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm Greg Prince.
Hi, I'm Rick Bennett, and welcome to Gospel Tangents. In November 2015, a policy known as the exclusion policy prohibited children of gay parents from being baptized or ordained, and also called gay couples in apostasy. However, earlier this year, the church announced that the policy would be reversed. This has caused a little bit of revelatory whiplash among members, especially more Orthodox ones. Dr. Greg Prince will talk about the fallout of both the institution and the reversal of this policy, and we'll talk a little bit more about the political fight on gay rights. Check out our conversation. Hey, one more thing. I'm going to be in the Kansas City / Independence area June 2nd, 3rd week of June. So if you're going to be in the area, I'd love to get together. Just send me an email at gospeltangents@gmail.com, and I'd love to do some church sightseeing while you're there. So let me know, and we can arrange plans. Now back to our conversation.
Let's talk a little bit about Hawaii. I think a lot of people, especially maybe heterosexual people, aren't as familiar with this fight. And can you talk about how that... Wasn't it this fight in Hawaii that also led to the Proclamation on the Family?
It's hard to say that it led to it. I think that they were parallel tracks that eventually converged, but the one was not formulated specifically to assist the other. In December of 1990, three gay couples in Honolulu went to the clerk and requested marriage licenses. They were turned down, as they expected. But on that basis, they subsequently filed a lawsuit challenging Hawaii law. They did it in the state courts because the Hawaii Constitution is much more liberal regarding sex, gender issues than the U.S. Constitution. The district judge dismissed the case on summary judgment, never went to trial. But the plaintiffs appealed to the state Supreme Court. And when it went to the state Supreme Court, the justices there said, because of our Constitution, this case has to be tried under the legal doctrine of strict scrutiny. Whereas the judge at the district level had dismissed it on the basis of what's called rational basis. Those are two levels of legal doctrine that govern how the courts respond to lawsuits challenging laws. Rational basis merely says the government can pass laws that people don't like and that even, well, that people don't like as long as there is a reasonable basis for doing so. One of the easiest examples to think about is tax increases. Nobody likes tax increases. But if you go to court and challenge a tax increase, you're likely to lose because there is a compelling reason that the state needs to raise money. Strict scrutiny says if a law discriminates against a class of people, the state has the onus of proving to the courts that there is a compelling public interest that is being served that justifies the discrimination. That's a lot of words. Example, many states, probably most states, have laws forbidding marriage of first cousins. Well, that's obviously a discriminatory law. It's putting a different standard to them than it does to the rest of the population. But there is a compelling state interest because of health issues, that if you have first cousins marrying, you're going to have an increase in recessive genes that can be expressed and a higher incidence of some fairly serious genetic and medical conditions. So those laws are allowed to stand. When the Supreme Court sent the case back to the district court and said, you must try this under strict scrutiny, then it became the burden of the state to prove that prohibiting gay marriage advanced the interest of the state, which meant they had to prove in a court of law under cross-examination that gay marriage was somehow damaging to the state. That had never happened before. So when that decision was handed down by the state Supreme Court, the ripple effect went all the way across the country, and state after state immediately started to enact legislation, either laws or amendments to state constitution, to try to set up a firewall so that, assuming, as everybody did, that the Hawaii lawsuit would result in the legalization of same-sex marriage, states outside of Hawaii did not have to respect marriages that were performed in Hawaii if they involved same-sex partners. And the ripple effect reached the U.S. Capitol as well and resulted in the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which Bill Clinton was forced to sign because there was a veto-proof majority in both houses.
Okay. And so that's how we got DOMA.
That's how we got DOMA. And it was all an effort to block the ripple effect of the Hawaii lawsuit because everybody assumed that that would be decided in favor of the plaintiffs. And ultimately it was, but the other option going through the legislative process was then invoked in Hawaii. So that rather than dealing with the courts and the lawsuit, the church shifted gears and started to work on the legislative process, and eventually there was a state amendment to the Constitution that contravened the lawsuit.
Okay. So that was passed in Hawaii?
Yeah. It was the same thing that later happened in California.
In California, okay.
If there had been a law, the law was struck down by the courts because it was unconstitutional, and then they fixed the Constitution. Same thing happened later in California, Prop 22 and Prop 8. In both cases, eventually, the federal courts struck both of those laws down, saying that they are unconstitutional in light of the U.S. Constitution.
Okay.
Which always supersedes state constitutions if there are conflicts.
And so the Family Proclamation didn't really play a role as far as gay rights?
No, it played a very minor role. Twice the church tried to intervene in the court case and become a co-defendant because church leaders felt that the Hawaii Attorney General would not mount a robust defense of the existing law. The first time they were smacked down at the district court level, which said, you have no standing in this. And then a couple of years later, they appealed that to the state Supreme Court, but they were turned down again. The brief that they filed the second time, which was in 1996, included in its appendix the proclamation on the family, which had been rolled out by the church the prior year. But it was not written specifically to advance the church's cause in the Hawaii case. It was much more broad in its intended effect. But yeah, it was borrowed at that point, but it was a minor thing. It was a footnote.
Okay. So why was the proclamation put out then? Because I've always thought it was to deal with a man and a woman, or a child should be raised with a man and a woman as a parent. And
it's not been clear to me what the 1, 2, 3 steps were in getting it started. I know that there were professors at the BYU Law School who had a hand in some of the early drafts of it. Curtin McConkie, the law firm that does much of the church's legal work, had a hand in it. It went back and forth with the Q15. I think that there was a realization that in order to have not just standing in the courts, but in order to draw a line for church members, that there was a need to define what the church felt the family was. Most of the proclamation on the family is positive. I would say at least 90% of it. But the other part is not positive, and it clearly is lashing out and staking out a position against gay marriage. Now, there's an interesting phrase in there such that if the church ever were to take a different position, it could grab that. And it says, gender is eternal. That can cut either direction, depending on how you want to define it. So we'll see.
Well, that's kind of a nice little segue into, I guess, Mormon theology as far as gender, because we really don't have any. Well, can you just talk a little bit about Mormon theology, especially as relates to same-sex marriage?
I think that our position as a church effectively represents a reverse engineering of an afterlife theology. Because LDS afterlife theology does not recognize gay. And so if it does not, then if you reverse engineer that into the present, you say, well, if it can't exist there, then it's not legitimate here. And that leads to the behavioral paradigm of homosexuality. Look, there is no legitimate state of homosexuality, so this is just a temporary chosen thing, and you can choose yourself out of it. So buck up and start acting. Acting manly, because most of the focus has been on gay men in the church, not on women. But if you dig deeper into LDS theology, particularly going back into the first decade of the church's existence, you see that afterlife theology went through a substantial evolutionary process. That where we are now is not where we started. And that begs the question, are we at a permanent stopping point, or, using the phrase from one of our articles of faith, is there yet to be revealed something else? I don't know the answer to that, but I don't have a closed mind about it either. Both because we have that fundamental doctrine of continuing revelation, which means continuing change, and because historically you can look back and see how that and every other significant doctrine in the church has changed somehow at some point since 1830.
Yeah, I know we talked a little bit about that last time, and I think that was one of the great quotes that you said was, there's no doctrine that hasn't changed significantly.
I've yet to see one, and I've yet to have somebody point one out to me. I'll qualify that by saying a significant doctrine. Who knows what little tidbits here or there that we've ignored? I don't know. I haven't seen one yet.
Well, you know, another thought is, I know last time when I talked to you, we had the November policy in place, and that was removed right a few days before General Conference.
Yeah.
I know some people made an interesting observation last night at your book signing that there was not a single mention of that. Why do you think that was?
I think that's because they had good input from public affairs. That if you're going to announce something like that, which is not real cheery news for the institution, because you're erasing something that people thought was permanent when you called it a revelation 3 years earlier, the way to do it essentially is what the government does when it has bad news. You announce it after 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. So that by Monday, people have pretty much moved on. And by announcing it a couple of days before General Conference and then not mentioning it, it became non-news. I think that was a good move on their part.
So, you know, and I know a lot of people, I know that I was very happy with the announcement. But I know a lot of people have been just as upset. And I think the main reason why is because there was no apology, and I know Elder Oaks is often quoted as, the church doesn't apologize. Yep. Do you think it would have been a PR win if the church had said, we know there's been some damage done here, or do you agree with Elder Oaks, the church just doesn't apologize?
No, I don't agree with that. I think they should apologize on multiple things. And it would have been a PR win if they had said humbly, we apologize for the damage that this has done, because demonstrably it did a lot of damage. Families were ripped apart. I think there's good evidence that more than a few people took their lives over this. And you can't undo that by reversing the policy. that's the real residual damage of this thing. It's not like, okay, we went there, now we've come back, now let's go on, and life goes on as it did before. But it doesn't. You step in something and you step out of it, but you still got it on your shoes. And that's where we are. How do you undo that kind of damage? And it also creates a dilemma that may even affect the Orthodox Church member more than the Progressive Church member, and that is, wait a minute, you told us this was revelation, and now 3 years later, you're saying it's back to where we were? That creates a real dilemma.
I have actually seen some Orthodox members say, I think the church is now in apostasy.
Yes. Yes. It's an unforced error. But nonetheless, it's something that they're going to have to deal with. And it has repercussions because it affects the whole brand of revelation. If people thought that something being called revelation conferred permanence to it, now it becomes much more relative, and it has a ripple effect beyond that particular revelation. It calls into a question others and say, well, how unchangeable is the rest of it? In my mind, changeability is bedrock for Mormonism, but it's something that makes most church members really nervous. They will embrace the concept of continuing revelation, but they're really hesitant to accept change. It's a paradox.
Well, you know, I've seen some people comment, and I would love to have you comment on this. You know, there's the story of Aaron and the golden calf, that when the Israelites came through, and Moses was up in the mountain, and Aaron acquiesced to the sinful nature of the people and gave them a golden calf. I know that there are some Orthodox members that use that as a parallel with this policy and say, well, maybe the members are so sinful and the leaders are giving us what we want as a people. How would you respond to that analogy?
I don't know how to respond to it. I don't agree with that assessment. The whole dilemma that leaders of any religious movement have to deal with is, how do you tap into the divine will and make that accessible to your members? Not an easy thing to do. How do you discern the will of God and then translate that into action, into policy, into attitude? Does God change over time, or do we change and do we vary in our ability to discern what that will is? Those are big questions, and there's no easy answer for them. I don't have an answer. But I think that it certainly says that there's constant struggle, or needs to be, as leaders of any religious movement try to discern and make available to their believers that divine will.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Greg Prince. In our next conversation, I will ask him how many people left over the exclusion policy.
I have heard, I think from solid authority, that in the year following the announcement of the policy, over 60,000 people
in 1 year
resigned their church membership formally. And you would have to figure that more people would be likely just to walk away than to go through the process of writing the letter to have their name removed.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available in either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com. And you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript. And over here, we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.